Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. This is your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I have a really interesting guest with me today, and we have an interesting, the way we met was really an interesting story, too. I have Brett Hodges with me, and Brett is known to our Santa Barbara community as the board member on the Libero Theater board, who is the historian. And he's a fifth generation Californian, became interested in history about 40 years ago. He produced a documentary film for PBS about his great grandfather, Max Whittier. And we're gonna get into that a little bit. He's a board member at the Santa Barbara Historical Museum as well as the Libero, and decided a couple years ago to document every performance which had taken place at the Libero over its 150 years. Now he's up to 18,000 performances. Can you believe? And this is growing. He recently chaired the Libero's successful 6.5 million ovation celebration capital campaign. And he's been in Santa Barbara on his own ranch for 45 years. And a fascinating individual and really kind person. And so, Brett, I'm so glad that you can talk with us about your background and your history and the Libero's history. And I just want to say, we have discovered, Brett and I have discovered two things at the Libero that are really, really cool. And Brett, tell me a little bit about the background of those two objects.
Well, it was so fun to invite Elizabeth down into the bowels of the basement of the Libero Theater. And there are these mystery objects, which it dawned on me when I was reading a newspaper article from 1957, and it talked about a theft that had taken place at the Libero after a jazz concert. And Yeah, the joke is, you know, these hip cat, long-haired, you know, jazz customers, of course, would be the ones to pull a heist. But the executive director of the Libero came out closing the doors in the evening and noticed that one of four medieval, we now know them as pole arms. They're long weapons on wooden poles, was missing, and it got into the newspaper, but then a couple of days later, it was returned. It was found leaning up against the wall. So I saw this article, and I emailed the staff at the Libero. I said, wow, this is so amazing. I wonder whatever happened to these things. And nobody knows. A couple of people say, oh, this is a great story. 2 days later, I get an email from the production manager who runs all the stage operations, Todd Jarrett. And he said, what, these things? And he had a picture of these four things leaning up in a dark corner of the basement. So we get Elizabeth over and John to look at them. And the newspaper article had said that they were 16th century. So, of course, the question to Elizabeth was, could this possibly be true? Or were these just more modern props that were used in a play? And Elizabeth, with her detective skills, dived into it. And, well, I'll let you maybe share the final judgment, Elizabeth.
Okay, Richard. I actually, John is in the process of restoring. He's polishing these things up. So I'll go grab one so you can see what these look like. And they're deadly long. So the total length is about 10 feet. They're these almost like, you know, how you call it medieval lances, but they're not lances per se. They're actually the name for these is halberds, and they're medieval weaponry, very primitive looking. And so what you have, if you can picture this, Richard, is that the blade is three parts. So there's a long, like, hook nose, mm-hmm. huge hook nose at the one side. Mm-hmm. And then there's at the other side, there's like a smaller hook and what is called a gaffer. Ooh. So what that means is you could, let's say you're fighting with someone and this person's, mm-hmm.
Right behind you.
Watch your head, Elizabeth. It's coming to get you.
That's right.
Let's see if he's doing it. Yeah,
put the, I'm gonna get you.
Oh my god!
Yeah, hey! Watch! Hey, watch out for my eye! Watch out for my eye!
Oh,
you could.
Yeah, there it is. And you see, it's really tall. So can you stand up with it?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's you tall, can. If you,
well, I mean, but it doesn't. Your camera doesn't get it.
Oh well, let me just look at. Okay, there so you can see how tall it is.
Oh my heavens! And how tall are you, John?
6'2",
and that thing's even taller than you. It's 7 feet, maybe.
No, it's over 9 or 10 feet.
Okay.
Wow, that is amazing.
That is incredible. And is the knight?
What he's showing
is the knight with the horse out the front.
What he's showing are the three prongs of this weapon.
Wow.
And then he's also showing what's called chasing. So the chasing is the engraving on the weapon itself.
Yeah.
And that was a real clue, Richard, as to the age of this pole arm and why they call it a pole arm. Because, okay, this is getting into physics a little, but if you've got an eight or 10 foot pole attached to your hand, can you imagine the kind of velocity and swing you can get? So,
you know,
it's that's why these things are so big and so heavy, because, you know, one good swing of your hand mm-hmm. can bring so much more force, and they are deadly, you know. So so that one side, that hook that you saw, that's for taking somebody and pulling them off their horse.
Yeah.
The other side, the axe that you saw, is for chopping through armor.
Yeah.
Where was
that when Mary Queen of Scots needed it?
They weren't actually around, and it's interesting that you should bring that up, because I believe in that era. Uh-huh. So, you know, the Elizabethan era, said 16th century as well. In that era, most palaces had armed guards at the entryway. Mm-hmm. That held those posts.
Yeah.
They were guards, and they still do. If you think about the Pope in the Vatican.
Oh, yeah. The Swiss guards.
That's right. So the Swiss guards have those sorts of weapons, exactly like that, with the three prongs. And so do the yeomen, I don't know how to pronounce it, of the guard in Britain. Yeoman, is it?
Yeoman,
right?
Yeah.
At Windsor Castle?
Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, Elizabeth, this is amazing. When you say, I mean, the joke about Elizabeth the First, Mary Queen of Scots, they are that old.
Hmm. Oh yeah. Well, yeah. So what we discovered because of the. So I have to just say that this scene of this meeting Brett for the first time and some of the staff of the Libero, Richard. There we are in the basement of the Libero now. The first Libero that was on that site was an old school. What was the date on that, the first Libero, Brett?
The Opera House opened in 1873 and closed in about 1916.
Hmm.
Okay. And is that, I always wanted to ask you that, is the old Opera House on the same footprint, same site?
Yes. They scraped it off. It was one of the largest adobe buildings in California. And they decided they couldn't remodel it into an opera, into a new modern theater. So they took it away, and they built the new theater in 1924 on the foundation of the old opera house.
Wow!
On the foundation.
Yeah.
And so that basement was the same basement.
I suppose so. There's supposed to be even an old water well that's sort of in the middle of that basement somewhere that's covered with rocks.
We found it. We have a small child down in there now, and we're keeping
No,
them.
No, no. It's covered with rocks.
Yeah.
Brett, Brett, you say that that water well is what now covered with what?
Well, there was a water well. It was supposedly in the middle of the stage or underneath the stage that I'm sure is covered, was covered with cement or something when they built the new theater, but funny location.
Hmm. Well, I have a story about that just real quickly before we go to break. So these cisterns, I'm discovering what you're calling a water well cistern. These cisterns were all around Santa Barbara. And how I discovered that was we had one of those incredibly severe plumbing issues where they either had to lift the house or they had to go under our house, under the foundation, and break through the layers mm-hmm. of foundation to get to the plumbing issue. There was no other way they could get to this plumbing issue. And it was a couple of weeks in men actually, because they couldn't get where it was, they couldn't get a vehicle. So they had to do it by hand and jackhammer the foundation. And as they were doing that, they broke through the concrete and they discovered a stone that was in the shape of a corner. Now, stones don't naturally grow in the shape of an exact corner. And this was limestone.
Oh.
Or sandstone. I can't remember the kind of stone. But at any rate, the plumber said, this looks like it's part of an old, an antique plumbing whatever. And he said, this looks like an old water well, an old cistern to me. As he was underneath there, he was jackhammering this up. Well, I got in touch with our dear friend, Michael Redman, at the Historical Society. You know him, right, Brett? Real
yes.
Well. Yeah. And I said, do you happen to have any plans, early plans of this intersection? So it's, you know, Pedregosa Prospect and Emerson. It was, you know, right there. Do you have any old plans or pictures, photos of this intersection? And he did. Because this was redeveloped in 1955, and he had an aerial shot from 1955 showing the old footprint of the old farm that was here. And lo and behold, that was a big cistern. It's underneath half my house, that cistern. And Michael explained to me that there's many hidden under many foundations.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, because really? Water was scarce. Yeah. And so I showed Michael the photos here, and lo and behold, he discovered also that there was a natural stream that was diverted when this property was turned over. And so that was what was filling the cistern. And it'd be really interesting to know if at the Libero there was any water source close by that was sealed off that filled that cistern.
You're right.
If there,
you're right.
Yes. Yeah. So if there was a cistern underneath the Libero and still exists and filled with concrete, there had to have been a water source close by.
You're right. You're right.
And one could prove the existence of the other. Yeah. So you know, Richard, it's so interesting when you think about the chain of causes that lead to something, isn't it? You know, and you could say, well, there's all these chains of events that lead to, you know, sort of psychological or karmic happenings yeah. in our lives. But I hold that there's a chain of events that happen around objects.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Although don't ever use the phrase, and this device changed the course of history. Unless you're a seer into the future, how do you know?
Well, I guess you could say, well, let's see if I can turn that into a story. So you could say that weapon that we just looked at, that Brett discovered in the basement of the Libero, mm-hmm. and now we're learning that basement is the old foundation that goes back to 1873.
Uh-huh.
So think of all the hauntings thereupon.
I was just thinking, okay, has he disturbed the spirits, so to speak, by removing that artifact?
Oh, Well, let's go to break. And we'll ask Brett when we get back from the break. How interesting. Yeah. What an interesting thought. Boy.
All right.
Yeah. Good move, Richard. Okay, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. I'm speaking with Brett Hodges. Super interesting conversation. He is the head historian for the Libero Theater. And we were, how I got involved was Brett asked me to come and take a look at four ancient weapons that are 8 to 10 feet tall each. And they're these big, you'd almost want to say, kind of lance-like things, but they have technical names, medieval names. And we're talking about the setting in which they were found. Brett had read a newspaper article from 1957 saying one of them was stolen, and he wondered where they had been in the Libero, and one of the managers there had been around a long time. I think Brett, he said 40 years or so.
Right.
He remembered where they were. They were leaning up against a corner of the deep, dank bowels of the Libero Theater. And we pulled them out and looked at them. And I did the appraisal. I think two are 16th century and two are perhaps 19th century. And Simon Rycroft, who was also on this program, he's an expert in armory, arms and armory and sidearms. He took a look at them as well. And he confirmed that he thought that I was probably right about that. But we're talking about all things Libero. And we were talking during the break about perhaps there's an old cistern under the Libero. And you asked if the taking away of an artifact that had been at the Libero for so long would have disturbed a spirit in the basement. And Brett said, wait a minute, I've got a great story. So let's turn this over to Brett.
Well, in the course of all my research trying to document every performance, I have found that, gosh, at least three people have died in the current theater since 1924. The most famous happened in 1938. It's arguably the most famous real-life death on stage in the history of theater. So you can imagine this thing is going to be pretty sensational. It's the grand opening of a play that is it's being previewed in Santa Barbara to then go on to LA and Broadway. And there's this actor in it named Joseph Greenwald. He's probably in his 40s. This is 1938. He plays the father of the main character in the play. And in one of the key pivotal moments of the play, he comes on stage and his line is, I've been waiting all of my life for this very moment. And at that moment, he actually, in real life, grabs his chest and falls flat to the stage. All of the audience think it's part of the play. I mean, the irony of it happening right after those lines. But no, he actually had a heart attack and he died on stage after saying, I've been waiting my entire life for this very moment. It was covered internationally by the New York Times. I wrote an article about it. I actually contacted his ancestors. I found them on ancestry.com. And I said, you know, your relative, you know, is one of the most famous real life deaths on stage. What does the family feel about it? And it was very sweet. They said, oh, yes. A young girl, she said, my mother who's here, he was her uncle. And they always felt that it was okay because he died doing what he loved. But it was sort of a, you know, very ironic moment.
This is 1938, you say?
1938.
Do you know what the name of the play was? Do you remember?
It was called The Golden Boy. It was directed by Stella Adler, you know, the famous.
Oh, sure.
Became a famous acting coach on the East Coast. Golden Boy, Clifford Odette. Yeah. It was the actor Glenn Ford's first acting appearance. He had a bit role, and he was the one. He saw this Joseph Goodman collapse on stage. He ran in on stage from the wings, and he knew something was really wrong. He tried to revive the actor, and he couldn't. And he called for the curtains to be dropped, and people were screaming. But he wrote about it in his autobiography. He said it was you know, sort of a bad start to an acting career.
Well, it's one better than break a leg, right?
Yes, yes.
One better than break a leg. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the I promised you, dear listener, to talk about the iconography and how I thought that Richard's comment about this is something that changed history. So, Richard, in regards to weaponry, okay, I'll make it quick because Richard's giving us a signal. We got to go to quick break. But Richard, in weaponry, in the West, you know, Europe, America, Canada, in the West, we as a civilization, you know, from the medieval times, we call it the Dark Ages. We emerged through a process called the Renaissance. Previous to the Renaissance, the church ran most militaries, and which is kind of a interesting turn of events because the church is supposed to be all about peace. But the church, you know, the church was the head of, for example, if you think of the Crusades beginning in the 12th century, the church is behind all crusading. Mm-hmm. And if up to the 16th century, the late 16th century, up to the late 16th century, if a weapon wasn't mentioned in the Bible, it was not allowed to be used on the field of battle.
I'm not surprised.
Yes, which meant that all of the Greek and Roman technologies of war were not able to be used. So hence weaponry like you just saw and that we discovered in the basement of the Libero, that kind of weaponry still in use in the 16th century and still carried by papal guards today, mm-hmm. that actually when the Renaissance came upon Europe, that it did change the course of history because it was discovered the ancient ways of Greek and Roman battle were rediscovered. Hmm. And so, you know, after almost 2,000 years. So the weapon that we just showed you that we discovered, Brett and I discovered in the Libero basement, that actually was going obsolete very quickly as new weapons were developed. For example, the catapult mm-hmm. and things like this, cannon, you know, things like this. So as far as modern warfare, people study that era as if it was epoch changing. So, you know, there is some grounds for that. Anyway, let's go to quick break. I want to talk when we get back with Brett's permission about Max Whittier. Max Whittier is Brett's great grandfather. And I was looking into him a little bit last night, kind of a really interesting character, a Californian down to his cotton socks and a rags to riches story. So I want to talk a little bit about that, Brett, with your permission, we get back from the break.
Sure, sure.
Richard, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. We're just talking with Brett Hodges, fascinating stories of the old Libero, how we got into this history lover's position at the Libero is that years ago, 40 years ago, he produced a documentary film for PBS on his great-grandfather, Max Whittier. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about Max, Brett.
Well, it is a great American rags to riches story. He was born in Caribou, Maine, which is up in the very top of Maine, just after the Civil War. His dad had been injured at the Battle of Gettysburg. I mean, they were as poor as poor, homesteading and digging up potatoes in poor soil up near the Canada border. He had a cousin who had come out to California and invited him to come out and try it out. It was a better life. So I think he had like $5 in his pocket. He got on a train, came out to California. And in 1890, he started work with the Union Oil Company, which just started in Santa Paula, California, which was a story I didn't realize that, you know, a big oil company started in Santa Paula, just in the hills between Santa Paula and Ojai. They struck oil and became a big deal. So he was a kid. He was maybe illiterate, big, strong guy, farmer. Came out, did a lot of roughnecking. In the early 1890s, oil was discovered in downtown Los Angeles, and it created this frenzy. Every house in downtown Los Angeles had an oil derrick in the back. It turned out to be a big oil field. And so my great-granddad went down there, and he formed a partnership with a friend, and they called their little drilling company the Hardly Able Oil Company. So he had a sense of humor. And, you know, one thing led to another. Kern County, there's a big discovery in the late 1890s at the Kern River. He goes out there, he camps out, and he, you know, it's one of those stories where you gamble all you have on something and it turns out to be okay. I mean, it could have gone the other way, but he gambled and turned out to be some good oil patches. One thing led to another. And the irony of the whole thing is this potato farmer from Caribou, Maine, in about 1910, becomes one of the owners of this big rancho in Los Angeles called Rancho de las Aguas. And he and his four partners decide, they drill for oil, and they don't find oil, but they find water. And so they decide, well, we can't make this an oil field. Let's make it a housing, a community. And so he becomes one of the founders of Beverly Hills. So it's a Beverly Hills, I mean, Beverly Hillbillies really could have been written about his life, but I never met him, of course. He died in 1925, only at the age of 55. But he was sort of a legend in the California oil business and then stepped into this sort of crazy role of founder of Beverly Hills.
I only have one thing to say to that. Wheel doggies.
Yeah. Black tea.
Yes. Yes. So an amazing story. And so his children, he had kids.
He had kids and I had three boys and one daughter. And his daughter was my grandmother. And, well, another part, the funny part of the story, he was a man of money, but limited taste, I think. And he decided to build a big mansion on Sunset Boulevard, which later became that sort of famous, infamous house. It was the Steve Martin movie was filmed there. And then one of the Saudi sheiks owned it and made it very garish. And but the funny part is that he builds this mansion and he decides to furnish it by buying the entire Italian exhibit from the World's Fair in San Francisco, 1916. I guess he went up there and he liked all of that dark wood furniture and he said, hey, don't ship it back to Italy, send it down to Beverly Hills. And so he furnishes the house with all this furniture. Yeah, it was just a colorful story. But he died very young, and then his kids lived in the house by themselves for about 10 years, and then they sold it off.
So do you see any, of course, it's all apocryphal history because you never met him. So the question is, do you see anything of him in any of your relatives or your kids or... Is there some kind of resemblance in some way, not just physically?
That would be very hard to tell. The physical resemblance, I did a fun thing for a family reunion we have every 2 years. I did a graphic showing he was apparently a very large man. I was like 6'4". And there's a lot of height in my family. So I did this funny chart showing men and women how unusually tall they are. And it all goes back to Max Whittier. You know, whether that's true, I have no idea, but it was sort of a fun little thing to play. No, I don't know if there are any personality characteristics that would have come through.
But the height thing, definitely.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
How interesting. And, you know, Richard, what I'd like to do, Richard, is go to a quick break now. But when I get back, when we get back from the break, I want to talk. I'm going to throw a question out to Brett. So he has researched 18,000 performances. He's made a list over the libero's 150 years of the performances in total. And so right now we're up to 18,000. He's researched 18,000. So he knows. I wish I would have known, Brett, when I discovered a lot of playbills in a woman's appraisal. I was doing an appraisal for her, discovered a lot of playbills, and she unfortunately threw them out.
Okay.
So if you're listening and you've got playbills or any kind of history of the libero, we please get in touch.
Yeah.
I want to know, when we get back from the break, if you could have been in the audience of any of those 18,000, what would your top three performances that you would have attended had been? What would they have been?
Wow. Okay, let me think quick.
Okay, yeah. When we get back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about that. Richard, let's go to quick break. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. My great pleasure speaking with Brett Hodges, who's the historian for the Libero Theater and also on the board there and on the board of the Historical Society. We don't call it the Historical Society. We call it the Historical Museum now.
Yeah.
So we're talking a little bit about his documentation of 18,000 performances on the boards at the Libero. And I asked Brett if he could go back and be in the audience at three, which three performances would he choose?
That is such a good question. I would have to say I would have liked to have been there in the 1870s when they had seances on stage. Believe it or not, they did have seances on stage. And I would have liked to have seen that. Because the next night, there would probably be someone who would be showing how everything that was done at the seance was just a magic trick and that spiritualism wasn't real. So spiritualism was a big, big deal in the 1870s, 1880s, after the Civil War. I would have liked to have seen one of those. I would have liked to have been there in 1941 in July, when the premiere of a play by Eugene O'Neill was presented at the Libero. Eugene O'Neill was there. Alfred Hitchcock, Charlie Chaplin were in the audience. The lead performer of the play was Ingrid Bergman. And it was in her autobiography, she said that was the first time she ever felt really famous, when crowds were lining up in front of the theater and they had big Klieg lights shining up into the sky. So the Libero really helped jumpstart the careers of an amazing number of legends. I mean, Ingrid Bergman, Clark Gable, Humphrey Bogart, Lucille Ball, Bing Crosby. I mean, they appeared there early in their careers, got good reviews, and went on, and it sort of helped their careers shine. So I would have liked to have been there that night just to have seen Alfred Hitchcock and Charlie Chaplin, I think, and Ingrid Bergman. And then knowing that a few months later, Pearl Harbor would be bombed and that whole Hollywood golden age would really come to an end. I mean, talk about being on the cusp of history. I mean, that summer was the end of the old times.
So what was the name of that play Bergman was in?
It was called Anna Christie, and it was a Eugene O'Neill play. And he was there. It's a dark play. She plays a prostitute, on the dockyards. The content seemed very dark, and I think it was probably a challenge for her to play, but she got good reviews.
Wow. And the seance, so it was a debunking kind of exercise then in 1870s.
No, they would have, what I was trying to say was that one night they would have a seance, and then the next night they would book somebody who would stand up on stage and say, what you saw last night was not true. And I'm going to show you why it's not true. I'm going to do all those little things just using magic tricks. So the table rapping, the bugle blowing, all of these sort of things, these funny little things that were part of the spiritualist age can absolutely be done with trickery. And so you'd have these competing audiences. One night, all the believers would be there, and then the next night would all the skeptics.
I see. Okay. Interesting. And so it was a seance on stage, and then they had somebody who was sort of like the anti,
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's two.
That's
What's
two.
Three?
Okay. Number three, how about 1962? Joan Baez is, she's barefoot and she is the quintessential, folk singer. And the libero at that time was very stodgy and very reluctant to present modern music. And so I'm just blown away that the board said, hey, let's have this, this woman come on stage barefoot and sing her folk songs. But it was the very beginning of her career. It would have been really memorable to have seen. So I think Joan Baez, 1962.
Oh, interesting. Fantastic. And when you're looking into the performances themselves, are you using the archives, for example, of the newspapers and this sort of thing?
Yes, the digital digital newspapers. UCSB has all of the ephemera print collection. So they've got 100 boxes of programs and board minutes. And so I go through that as well. I don't know if I'll finish it in my lifetime. Frankly, this job, it's sort of a huge task, and I'm only about 2/3 finished. But it's fun.
Oh, how interesting. So and the other thing I wanted to talk about, and Richard, this is remember I said at the beginning of the hour that there was two objects that Brett asked me to look into in the basement of the libero. And I want to talk a little bit about the second object when we get back from the break with Brett's assistance. So let's go to a quick break, and then we'll talk about something that's really kind of spooky. So don't turn that dial. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. My great pleasure speaking with Brett Hodges, a historian for the Libero Theater. We're talking about some of the wonderful plays that have been performed on those boards. And also below the theater, there is a basement, and we're talking about various kind of hauntings and interesting things that go on in a basement of a theater, in the bowels of a theater. And we talked a little bit about Richard brought up the idea that if you took those weapons we talked about out of the theater, if maybe somebody, some spirit would have been disappointed in us. Well, there's something else I want to tell you about, listener and Richard. There's an old piano down there that's stuck in between a row of Klieg lights and a corner, and it's just wedged in there, and it's on its side. So the keyboard is vertical. And it's not the piano that we know today. It's a type of piano called the Square Grand. And they date to around the end of the Civil War. And they are built like a coffin. And the strings run right to left to right, et cetera. As opposed to the Concert Grand, which is, you know, the shape of the pianos we have on stage at the Libero now. And that got me really interested because I had my grandfather, Brett, was a great engineer who invented a lot of things around a concept in physics called resonant frequency. And I remember my grandfather telling me that if you had an instrument with strings and you, of course, the piano's a stringed instrument. If you had a note that sounded that was the same resonance of what the string would have produced, the string would vibrate in harmony in resonance with the note. And I remember my grandfather explaining it to me. Of course, I was an arts kid and I didn't understand the math of it, but he was a great genius in that regard. And I thought to myself, if there was a piano in the basement that was hidden away and wedged in between walls, et cetera, the strings actually would have been resonant with any music happening on the stage. And that piano, why was it there? When Brett told me everything that was in the old Libero was sold when they built the new Libero. So why was that piano still there? And yes,
I mean, I love the way Elizabeth can look at an object. I think what's special about you, Elizabeth, is that you can look at an object and you're not just trying to describe what it is, but you're also trying to describe it's the context of why it is in a place or in a person's home. And I think that's really interesting. The why is really interesting.
Well, the idea that piano has been there is sort of singing or listening and responding. And it got me thinking, how many years has it been in that position of singing and responding? I don't know if you remember, Brett, but I pressed one of the keys and it makes noise.
Yeah.
Still, it has no legs. It has no lid. It has no key protector. It has very little. So the story of this, Richard, is, I got in touch with one of the few historians in this country of square grand pianos. And I sent him pictures, although it's really hard to get a definitive picture down there. But I sent him pictures and he said, well, it's likely to be this maker, this age, or a similar maker of a similar age. And then I said to Brett, you know, what play... We thought through this problem together, what play involved the piano? And lo and behold, the opening play of the new Libero in 1924. Tell me more.
Well, it was called Bareback.
Beggar.
Beggar on Horseback. And it was a surreal sort of political satire that was already appearing on Broadway. And it was a real coup that Santa Barbara was able to get the rights to use it in an amateur production to open the Libero Theater in 1924. And it was the Fiesta. The first Fiesta was just taking place. So it was at the first Fiesta play.
And it involved the piano because?
Well, I haven't read the script as well as you have, but apparently a lot of it is a dream sequence, the play. And the main character has a piano and he's conflicted between marrying into riches and staying a legitimate artist. And there's a piano in it that you discovered. And so perhaps this is the beggar piano.
Well, that would, if it was, that would be an explanation as to why it was kept in the basement. But we, what was interesting is that I did not know until just this interview, Brett, that that basement could have been the same basement of the old Libero.
Well, I don't think so. I think they would have scraped everything clean.
Okay, okay. But the footprint is still there. It's just a whole different basement.
The concrete could be the same, but everything on top of it was taken away.
Right. Brett, thank you so much for coming on. It's been such a pleasure. It was so cool to hear about Max Whittier as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for all the hard work you do over there. 18,000 performances documented for the future. That is so interesting. Just fantastic. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you so much, guys.